Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
In this episode of the Midweek Takeaway, we're joined by Rupert Verco, CEO of Cobra Resources, to discuss their latest milestone in advancing the Bolan project in South Australia. Cobra has achieved strong results from their in-situ recovery ISR bench scale study, confirming ISR as a viable and cost-effective mining method for extracting high-value ionic rare earth elements, with notable increases in recoveries, including 57% for magnet rare earth oxides. Cobra is making significant strides towards commercialization. Rupert will share insights on the project's potential, the low-cost ISR process, and what these results mean for Cobra's future in rare earth mining. Welcome back to the podcast, Rupert. How's life treating you?
Very well, Phil. How are you? Good to see you again, Kevin.
Well, good here. Thanks.
Yeah, all good.
So obviously, the main takeaway from today's RNS is that the study has confirmed that ISR is a suitable mining technique to deploy at Boland, supporting the company's ambition to commercialise the Ionic Rare Earths project. Tell us more, please, Rupert. As you must be enthused with the study's findings.
Yeah, look, Phil, we're absolutely stoked. I think if we were to look back at 12 months ago when we really started to consider what this opportunity might look like, and we said in 12 months time, if we can demonstrate that we could get in situ recovery results of between 50 to 60%, we'd be absolutely stoked. And if we could do that with low acid consumption, low impurities, and define it at grades that have really exceeded our expectation, well, we're not talking about a few hundred ppm here, we're talking about 0.45%, we would very much believe that we're on a winner. And now that we've had that validated, we're certainly very enthused and very excited about our next steps. But I think what's important, Phil, and I've had a lot of questions lately about our approach to this, I think what we've really considered through our processes as investors, what do we want to do to de-risk this project? Capital markets have been tight for the junior mining community. There's been a lot of interest in rare earths, and a lot of investments been probably, I wouldn't say burnt, but has fallen away on metallurgical results. So we wanted to de-risk our investment rationale by addressing that risk first, and we've done that through this metallurgical studies. It really gives us confidence now to push ahead, define a resource, and start ticking the boxes to define what the economic opportunity at this at Boland is.
Absolutely, yeah. I just want to focus on this ISR, this in-situ recovery, because how important it is in terms of, you've got much less surface disturbance than your conventional kind of open cut or underground mining methods. It doesn't involve the tailings there or any waste rock dumps or even open pits. And the processing plant is effectively small and easily removed after completion of the mining. So it also involves extracting minerals by dissolving them in situ, as in the name, yeah. And then obviously pumping the solution to surface for processing. So, I mean, this technique has been successfully employed in uranium extraction, as referenced in the RNS, in countries like Kazakhstan and Southern Australia, accounting for a significant portion of that global production. But I just don't think we can kind of downplay the importance of, let's say, the ethical and environmentally friendly mining techniques in this current day and age. So just talk us through how much of a game-changing process ISR is when mining for these ionic rare earths.
Yeah, sure, Phil. Look, I think there's a couple of very important points to really highlight with that. The first being that if you look at uranium production over the last 30 years, there was a pendulum shift in where uranium was sourced. And it went from hard rock mining to predominantly in situ recovery. And that was done through suppressed pricing. And it was because ISR, you can achieve a lower production cost per pound than what you can through hard rock mining and processing. But also environmentally, the legacy risk is much lower. And there are examples where it's almost a tenfold cost reduction in environmental rehabilitation costs between a hard rock uranium mine and an ISR mine. So that puts a value on it. And we think with the environment that we're working in, we can really do it in a way where we can integrate in situ recovery mining into the existing land uses. And I think probably the one real opportunity that we see, Phil, is anyone who operates a processing plant in any commodity will tell you how challenging it is to handle and treat clays. It's a real challenge, and it's very challenging to scale up. And ISR completely mitigates those issues. So that's our biggest opportunity. And whilst we're seeing projects develop in Brazil, there's obviously been issues with tailings dams in the past, and therefore they're going to require them to dewater or delogulate their clays to put them back in the ground. And that's not that easy. It costs money. And we see that as being a huge opportunity for us. And if we can demonstrate, and look, we're operating in the same geology as existing profitable ISR uranium mines in South Australia. That if we can apply this metric, we can scale it. We think we've got a pretty unique opportunity, and we can do it in a process that can be cost competitive with the producers in China that use a slightly different form of ISR to really dominate that low cost production of ionic rare earths and heavy rare earths.
So, Rupert, who will be the end user of this product?
Well, Kevin, have you bought an electric car yet, mate? I hope so. You're
I
doing
most
your
definitely
part.
not. I drive a 1991 Mitsubishi Pajero.
Well, look,
But actually, I do have a Chinese like seven-seater or whatever, which has a very small part of hybrid electric engine. So maybe that is part of it, yeah.
well, look, if you look at rare earth magnet usage and what the forecasts are for market demand, obviously electric vehicles fill or e-mobility also fills a huge part of that growing demand. But every application from an electric drill to your dishwasher or your washing machine will have rare earth magnets in them. Why are rare earth magnets important, Kevin? Because they last longer, they're more energy efficient in those electric motors. So, look, where we look at how the rare earth supply chain is developed at present, China controls a lot of the value add through that supply chain from mining through to the OEM production of those magnets. They export a lot of those magnets to out of China, but they retain a lot of that value. So look, there's two interesting components. I think we need to be realistic as a company about where our opportunity sits. If we're going to be producing a lot of heavy rare earths and we want to bring this online quickly, there's obviously a customer in China, but there's obviously the sovereign component to this that other countries are looking to prove up their sovereignty of critical mineral supply, and they're looking for projects to diversify supply chains. Whilst those supply chains aren't established, there's obviously significant interest in seeing that they do. So, look, I think, Kevin, that there's plenty of opportunity to fill demand, not just from those growing markets, but also from China as well. So, look, I think one thing that's important around our testing and our recovery work that we've done, we're taking it to the next stage of that flow sheet development. We're doing the impurity removal tests as we speak, and we will have produced our first mixed rare earth carbonate, which is a saleable product. And that's going to enable us to start speaking to those end users and to those buyers of that product to look at what offtake arrangements may look like. So that is going to be a significant milestone for us. And I think to paint the opportunity, Kevin, I'd say that, and I probably haven't quite cross-referenced it to the decimal point, but I don't think there's been any clay-hosted project, rare earth project in Australia that has produced an in-specification mixed rare earth carbonate. So we see a huge opportunity to be the first. And what do we need? We need those impurities to stay low. We need high quantities of rare earths, and we need low radionuclides. And the results that we've generated and announced to the market today are certainly a very positive indicator that we can do that, and we can do that through a very unique mining process. So
So,
we
do you
feel like
think there is the opportunity then, both with the European critical metals, or critical, I don't know whether it's called metals, but critical
minerals,
assistance,
yeah.
and also in the US, where they're looking for these supply chain critical metals, where we deal with Guardian Metal Resources for tungsten, and they're in the process of grant applications. So do you think, is there anything more specific to Australia, or is it we will go
Yep.
to Europe and the
Good
US and find out?
questions. Well, you look at the investment that's really been deployed from the government level in Australia. So we have Iluka with Ed and Abner for a rare earth separation facility in Western Australia. They've received a soft loan for a couple of billion dollars. And then Arafura with Nolans Bor in Northern Territories received a critical minerals loan as well. So there is certainly interest from the government level in these assets. I think we have a little bit further to get down the pathway to commercialization before that serious money can really become available. But absolutely, Kevin, we're looking at every opportunity to bring in that non-dilutive funding, because it's a very good, great way of also not bringing in dilution, but to get that endorsement to your project. That's something that we're looking very heavily at present.
What is the
The
actual what is the actual scale, the potential scale of this? You know, I mean, if you start to do in situ mining for this, and you're operating as you would like, how many tons of this stuff are you aiming at per annum?
Without doing the studies, I don't think we can quite speculate on that. But what I would say is we have not been in a rush to go and do the resource drilling, because we don't feel like the risk is there from a scale standpoint. We feel like we're going to be able to generate plenty of scale, hundreds of millions of tons. The risk for us was in the metallurgy and demonstrating to the market that it's amenable to in situ recovery. Look, I would like to say that we have a goal of being able to be a major producer. A major producer to produce 5 to 10,000 tons of MREC per annum would be good. And look, I'd like to think that this is a scalable opportunity, Kevin, where you can bring it into production at low capex, and you can build on that production as you work through your mine plan and scale it up. And why not shoot for the stars, Kevin, and dream to be the next Kazatomprom, but of the rare earths industry?
Yeah, I was just going to ask how that may look, Rupert, in terms of whether you would maybe look to establish like a partnership with refiners, or whether you would maybe develop in-house refining capabilities yourself. But I think you just kind of answered that. So is that what you'd maybe look to do an in-house refining?
Look, I think the first step, Phil, is to produce a mixed rare earth carbonate, which is a saleable product. How this or the pricing mechanisms work is you get paid on a payability percentage of that product. So there is value lost by only taking it to that point. But I think, Phil, it's important that we don't capital constrain ourselves. If we can be in the lowest quartile of producers of a mixed rare earth carbonate globally, and we can make money at existing rare earth prices, it'd be better for our shareholders to take this into production at that point and bring in cash flow before we consider what those growth strategies are. And if you look at the likes of Lynas and Mountain Pass, that's certainly an approach that they've deployed, and they've now looking at taking it to the next level.
So, Rupert, if we look at the results that came out today, you had 56% of Trio's, 57% Rio's, and 50% Hero's spelled incorrectly. Okay. Now, this was when pH level went down to 3. Okay. But then it looked like you took it then down to two and something
Nope.
else more
No,
positive
we've only
happened.
taken. Oh, sure. So in the bench scale test work, Kevin, so how in situ recovery works is we've used the permeability of our sample and we've injected our lixiviant in, and the pH of the sample started at above 7. That's taken us a period of time using that natural permeability to lower that pH, and we've started to promote the process that's called ionic desorption after a pH of, from memory, around 5.2, where we start to see the rare earths liberate to solution, and we've continued this test until we've taken it down to a pH of 3, where we've received those recoveries of 57% magnet rare earths, or I think 50% heavy rare earths, or your heroes, right? Which are your valuable metals. What we have done is normally with rare earth metallurgy, what inhibits you is your impurities. So everyone can get recoveries at lower or more acidic conditions. But when you take your leachate to a more acidic condition, you take everything else with those rare earths. You get more iron, more alumina, more uranium, more thorium. So what we've looked at is if we were to take our acidity down to a pH of 2, what would those levels of those impurities be? And what would our acid consumption, which is a significant portion of your operating cost, be as well? And when we've dropped it to a pH of 2, we're not receiving any further impurities. We're not getting much more acid consumption, but we're taking those recoveries from the 57% that we've achieved in our bench scale to over 80%. So we're seeing huge increases in those recoveries, and we're not doing it to the detriment of the quality of the product that we're extracting. So there's opportunity in us to be able to optimize what we've been able to demonstrate in this bench scale study. And what we'll be looking at doing, Kevin, the next time we scale up this test work in the not too distant future, is if we do it at a pH of 2 instead of targeting a pH of 3, what recoveries can we achieve? And does it speed up the process for ISR?
Yeah, I guess it's all about a balance, isn't it? Because you want the ideal pH balance carefully to kind of maximize the recovery while avoiding this excessive consumption of the sulfuric acid. So, do you think that it would be a kind of like trying to find somewhere in between the two and three to get the maximize, to get the best results?
Yeah, look, Phil, you're right. It's about achieving that balance. I think what we've seen between the test work between 2 and 3 is that the economics on acid consumption doesn't look to be our problem. What we need to demonstrate is that radionuclides will not be. So we don't want to have them in our product, and we don't think that, well, they're certainly not looking like they'll be there at pH 3, but we need to repeat the test work to see if they're there at pH 2. But look, I think from an investor standpoint, to be able to demonstrate these recoveries that we're achieving at these acidities, which not many, very few other projects in Australia have been able to do, and to couple that with in situ recovery, it's a pretty compelling opportunity.
So, from a scenario of what's next after these other tests, are we moving towards a pre-feasibility study in terms of where you are?
Yeah, the next step would be scoping study, Kevin. We've got a resource drill out to do before that. We're just waiting for our stakeholders, our farmers, to get their crops off the ground. It's spring, start of summer here, so harvest is in full swing. So we'll be very respectful of that, and we'd look to be out there drilling over summer to define what we would hope is a very scalable maiden resource, which will then enable us to support a scoping study. There's going to be a few other important components, Kevin, for it. We've already installed the infrastructure for an in-field study, and that first in-field study is going to be looking at the permeability rates that we can emulate and achieve in the field. It's not a full-blown pilot study. It's more, let's go out and test how long it takes to get a die to go from one hole to the other. And then we can model that back to the recoveries that we achieved at bench scale. And we can make some economic assumptions based on that test work. So that's really some cost-effective but highly valuable information that we can do. And I think they're the key points that we need to be able to really demonstrate the opportunity that we have here. And look, I think as a group, we've worked through similar processes before, and we're pretty confident that we're going to be able to deliver some promising permeability results in the field.
If you had unlimited money, how quickly could you get this all into production?
Geez, Kevin, if you pay me enough, mate, I'll get it into production next year for you. Look, I think the beauty of this is, Kevin, we have very cheap drilling ahead of us. We're not talking about great depths. We're talking about air core. So, look, the drilling cost is not going to be significantly high. We've done a lot of the de-risking work up front. We've done a lot of re-assay on historic results. We've defined a mineralization footprint that's extensive. And the follow-up test work that we really need to do already has the infrastructure in the ground. So we're not looking to be going out and raising a lot of money, but we have a regulatory framework that we need to work through. We did take a risk very early, Kevin, by putting these wells in the ground before we defined that resource. But part of that strategy was to address those environmental approvals up front. So we're basically 80% through our hydrology studies now to support those environmental approvals. So that's been a huge tick from our end that we need 12 to 18 months of data to be able to facilitate the approval process to be able to get a mining lease and to be able to take this into production. And we took a risk early to put the infrastructure in the ground to start capturing that data at the start of this year, as opposed to post-resource definition. So I'd like to say, Kevin, that we're considering what our hurdles and our challenges could be, and we're addressing them as quickly as we can. So, look, I'd like to think, mate, all things considered, that we could have a pilot study producing at a scale rare earth carbonate in the field within a year.
Very good. And that would produce enough to cover the costs of the overheads within Cobra, you think, even as a
I don't
pilot
think
study?
we've got, look, we do run at a pretty tight ship, Kevin, but I think the pilot study, what it would do is it would give us commercial quantities to fill potential offtakes. It would demonstrate process at a production scale, would be a very quick point to be able to go from that pilot level into a operational level. So look, I'd like to think that if you look at the average time frame of taking a discovery into production, I think roughly the industry average at the moment is about 18.5 years. I'd like to think that if we keep ticking all the boxes through a project pipeline, we could have this into commercial scale production within 3 to 4 years.
Very good. Now, tell us a little bit about the gold situation within Cobra, because obviously we've got all-time high gold prices of $2,700 plus US dollars, and I'm sure it's significantly higher in Aussie dollars as well.
Yeah, look, we're at about
So,
4,150, mate. And I think the
yeah.
last time I managed a gold operation, the gold price was under 2,000 Aussie. So it is. It's a phenomenal time in the gold price. And as we've discussed previously, the outlooks are very favorable. So Cobra's gold resource stands at 279,000 ounces. Look, there's upside there to be had. I think what we see at the moment is we see that we could be one of the best rare earth producers in globally, whereas our current gold resource couldn't produce a top 10 producer of gold. There's certainly value that we're looking to be able to realize for our shareholders. We have neighbors that are advancing projects privately. They're going through mining approvals. So that infrastructure and that capital outlay is something that is a challenge for a smaller gold asset. And if we can overcome that through a toll treatment agreement or a sale agreement to that producer, there's certainly plenty of value to be had on a resource of 279,000 ounces at these market prices.
Tell us what type of gold project is it? Are we talking about open pit? Are we talking about underground?
Very,
What is?
very, very shallow, mate. We're talking about 80% of those resource ounces sitting within 120 meters of surface. We're talking about grades, a resource grade of 1.5 grams. We have supergene enrichment zones that have much higher grades that are fairly shallow. So, look, if we look at it in terms of being a secondary operation to feed and supplement another mine, it certainly would stack up very favorably. And to put it into context, I've managed pilot or satellite pits of smaller scale than this that have been very profitable for a number of years. And they've been profitable because we've been able to bypass that upfront CapEx expenditure by using other plants and other infrastructure to treat that ore. So there's certainly a pathway, but we're certainly very much married to that infrastructure being developed in close proximity. But saying that, Kevin, if the gold price exceeds 5,000 bucks an ounce, mate, I might be trying to look for that capital to put that infrastructure in ourselves.
Yeah, who knows? Before we started to talk, we were talking about the gold and the silver prices. So give us your pearls of wisdom of what you think.
Well, look, mate,
Either is gonna
any.
happen, or could happen, or maybe it won't happen.
Jeez, Kevin, I'd probably be more chance of being able to tell you the winner of the Melbourne Cup tomorrow.
Well, tell us that as well. Well, you.
Look, well, tomorrow for the Melbourne Cup,
Start on the easy one, he says.
we'll go a nice South Australian horse, the Map, trained by some friends of ours. So let's hope the Map can salute tomorrow. And look, I think there's obviously a lot of geopolitical drivers that are driving the gold price in the macro sense. But as always, Phil and Kevin, what happens when the commodity price increases? You have more production come online, and more production generally means that you get a more competitive point of view from a buyer standpoint, and generally prices will level out at some point. I don't know when that is. And if the big banks keep buying, we might see much higher prices. So it's going to be very interesting, guys, to see what happens in the US election tomorrow. You guys got any tips on that?
I think Trump's going to win, personally. I think all the betting is saying Trump's ahead in the seven swing states. So I think it's going to
I'm
be a
going
Trump
Harry. I'm going
election.
Harris.
He always goes the opposite. I'm going that Trump's going to win, and he's going to also take both houses as well. He's going to take the Senate and the House. So,
Wow.
which probably is the least likely, but I think the least likely is also that if Harris wins, she takes both houses. It's highly unlikely. So
Sure.
we could be in stalemate again. You know, it doesn't really matter who the president is when the houses don't agree, or when you've got the Senate and the House against each other. So let's see what happens. But one thing is for sure, that I think when it happens, it will be an uncertainty out the way, whoever wins, to be honest. And I think that is going to be a good thing. Just when we were
That's
talking
good.
about gold prices, just give us your thoughts on rare earth prices. What has been happening with rare earth prices? Obviously you're in this space, so
Sure.
give us your idea of what that is, and then we'll call it a
Look,
day.
rare earth prices bottomed out early in 2024. We've seen some positive price movement. NdPr's back up around $60 US a kilo. In terms of the heavies, a lot of the heavies are sourced from the Ionic projects in southern China and Myanmar. There's a lot of social issues with some of that mining in Myanmar, and some of that production has been interrupted as a result of that. So what we think is that there will be a time where the Chinese will accept that they can't keep these rare earth prices where they are. We're seeing the likes of Lynas and MP not making money at the moment. So there will be significant opportunity to fill any further positive price movement, but the best opportunity sits with the lowest cost operations to come online, and that's really where we hope to be able to sit. And I think the important thing for us is, look, we could produce an MREC that has 30% heavy rare earths, and that's a huge weighting of heavies, and that's much higher than a lot of the other ionic projects in South America. And when those prices of those heavies, which are important for those magnets to be able to operate at higher temperatures, are in demand, hopefully we really see those prices move, and hopefully we're well positioned to really capitalize on that and to be able to scale up quickly.
So at $60 with the ISR and the processes that you're going through at the minute, you're going to be profitable.
Kevin, what I hope is that through our work process going forward, is we can demonstrate to the market that we can produce a rare earth carbonate for under US $10 a kilo. I have the history of uranium ISR production supporting that claim, in that the lowest producers of uranium are all in situ recovery operations. If we stood to do that, we would have a payability of around $30 US at current prices. So even at the low prices, we stand to be very economically competitive.
Yeah, you'll be producing money, not just rare earths.
Okay. I think on that note, we'll say Rupert Vercoe, CEO of Cobra Resources, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast again.
Thanks for your time, guys. Lovely speaking.
Thanks, Rupert. We'll hopefully hear from you in the not too distant, and we can wax lyrical again, and let's hope the Mac has won.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.